Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
What about the people who are barely keeping their heads afloat, who need this money to pay rent month to month, or they need this money to feed their family?
Alaskans seeking food stamps run into a huge backlog. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 3rd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, no House Speaker means no swearing in yet for Mary Peltola.
This is historic because even 100 years ago, it went to 2 rounds and then they adjourned.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Do you need health insurance? United Way Healthcare Navigators are here to help you understand your new Affordable Care Act coverage options and opportunity for savings. You can call 211 or text GETCOVEREDAK to 898-211 to connect to a healthcare navigator. Enrollment is open now through January 15th. Call 211 today. This message sponsored by United Way of Anchorage.
Thousands of Alaskans have been waiting without food stamps for months due to a backlog in the State Division of Public Assistance. Officials blame a 2021 cyber attack and a huge influx of paperwork after the state ended its public health emergency for the COVID-19 pandemic. But sources inside and outside the division say the problem goes back much further. KTOO reporter Claire Strempel has been following this story and joins us now. Claire, how bad is the problem and how did we get here?
The state said about 8,000 people are waiting for food stamps, some of them since September. But workers inside the Division of Public Assistance have said the number is much higher. And it's not just food stamps. The Division of Public Assistance also processes Medicaid and other federal assistance programs. Sources at Providence say they've seen mothers with babies in the NICU wait a month for their Medicaid applications to be processed. One medical provider, Heidi Young, says she's seen patients get stuck in the hospital for 60 to 90 days because the state doesn't process their Medicaid insurance.
And the fact that the legislature has been aware of this and the Commissioner of Health and Social Services has been made aware of this on multiple occasions, and they keep passing the buck. And I just think Alaskans need more support than that.
State officials say we got here because of a cyber attack on the department in 2021 and a large volume of paperwork after the state ended the public health emergency this summer. During the pandemic, there wasn't as much paperwork for food stamp benefits, but when it was over, everyone had to refile. Sources inside the department say the backlog goes back years and is due to understaffing and mismanagement.
Okay, but wait, did you just say people are getting stuck in the hospital for, what, 2 or 3 months because of what's essentially a backlog of paperwork? Wouldn't that end up costing a whole lot more?
It's expensive. But I learned from Jared Kosen, he runs a trade group for hospitals, that if someone's cleared for release from the hospital but has nowhere to go for lower-level care, the hospital can't let them leave. Insurance doesn't usually cover unnecessary hospital stays, so hospitals are actually on the hook to pay.
Well, that doesn't sound good for anybody. Anyway, back to the food stamps. Are people actually going hungry?
I've gotten emails from Alaskans who say they're skipping meals so their children can eat. That's not everyone's story. For some people, this just means their budget is a little tighter or that friends and family help out or they go to the food bank. For others, it can be really dire, like choosing between bills and food. There are different levels of food stamp benefits you can get that correlate to different levels of food insecurity. There's also a level of fear because Alaskans don't know how long they have to wait. Some people have been waiting since the fall and may have weeks to go. Last week, the state said they have about 950 applications from September left to process. The first source I talked to, Nikita Chase, spoke out because she started dipping into her emergency food supply and was worried about fellow Alaskans who didn't have moose set aside in the freezer like she did.
What about the people who are barely keeping their heads afloat, who, you know, need this money to pay rent for month to month, or they need this money to heat their homes, or they need this money to feed their families?
She said she had to skip paying her electric bill last month. But the good news is she called the state ombudsman and her case got processed. So she and her kids have their food stamps now.
Yeah, I guess having each individual family file a complaint with the ombudsman doesn't seem realistic, though. So What does the state say about how it's really going to fix this?
The state says it's working to onboard about 30 new hires, and that the division director has requested to hire several dozen more. Sources inside the department say those efforts are not sufficient, and one anonymous source said the state is not spending enough time to train new hires on the complex systems required to manage federal programs. If you look at the state's spending, you can see that the governor cut more than 100 jobs from the division in 2021. That doesn't mean layoffs. It means that when people quit or get promoted or retire, those positions are allowed to stay vacant. So this acute moment of understaffing has its roots there. State employees say their colleagues are quitting at a rapid pace. One said they were, quote, dropping like flies. The leader of the union that represents state workers, Marianne Ganassius, says it's gotten so bad that worker safety is actually her main concern at this point. She says workers get contacted outside of work and threatened by clients who have been waiting too long for help.
They're becoming a little more aggressive and volatile because of the backlog and not being able to access their benefits.
She's not sure the state's hiring will work if the workers feel unsafe.
So, Claire, you've reported this in a couple installments. What have you heard as you've been covering this story?
After the first story in December, KTOO was flooded with emails and calls from people who were waiting on food stamps. After the state finally talked to us for the second story, I started hearing from people within the department and people who help Alaskans get food stamps and other benefits like Medicaid. They say some stressed clients are taking out their frustration on workers, harassing them online, approaching them in the grocery store, calling them names, and even threatening them with violence. And they say this backlog problem isn't new. It goes back years, and that only systemic change can fix it. In other words, simply hiring new workers doesn't address the high turnover rates and workplace conditions that lead to them.
All right. Well, we trust that you will continue to follow this. That was KTOO reporter Claire Strempel. You can read her full reporting at ktoo.org or alaskapublic.org. Claire, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Casey.
Today is the day Mary Peltola was supposed to be sworn in for a full term in Congress, but that didn't happen. All the majority could agree on was to adjourn and try again tomorrow. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin caught up with Peltola during this day of limbo at the Capitol.
Nothing can happen in a new term in the U.S. House until the members elect a speaker. Republicans have a slim majority, but 20 hard-right Republicans voted for someone other than frontrunner Kevin McCarthy, blocking him from the speaker's chair. Peltola took a seat in the back of the House chamber and, like all Democrats, just kept voting for Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York.
Peltola. Jeffries.
Pence. Peltola. Jeffries.
Pence. Peltola. Jeffries.
Jeffries didn't have a majority either. So, after three rounds of voting, the first day of the new Congress ended in a stalemate. Peltola says it's a sign of the times.
It shows how divided within a party we are as Americans, and that's a concern.
It's highly unusual. Peltola notes that it's been more than a century since a vote for speaker took more than one round.
This is historic because even 100 years ago, it went to two rounds, and then they adjourned. And this, I believe, can go as many rounds as people can take.
She figures it'll eventually end when Republicans iron out their differences and elect a speaker. Peltola, in a black cusbuck and Yupik-style fur boots, was in demand in the Capitol hallways. A pair of Hakeem Jeffries staffers were delighted to bump into her. They pumped her hand and congratulated her repeatedly. They invited her to a reception room near the chamber where she could fuel up with mini quiches and other finger food. Yes, they said, by all means, bring your five kids. The kids! They'd come to Washington to watch their mom be sworn in. Instead, they were waiting in Peltola's office, two of them in Coast Guard uniforms.
I haven't seen them for 3 hours, I'll be texting.
But at the office, spirits were high. While Peltola was on the floor waiting to vote, Chief of Staff Alex Ortiz spoke about some of the new hires.
We're really excited to have new folks here in the D.C. office. We have built out our policy team in particular.
Peltola has hired Elizabeth Othmer as legislative director. It's a key position. Othmer is from New Mexico. Ortiz says it's often hard to find Alaskans who love their state to relocate to Washington, D.C. But Ortiz says the non-Alaskan hires have valuable expertise in House policy and procedure.
I think Representative Peltola will benefit from that, to be able to jump into the game really quickly in getting bills moving, passing legislation, to have them transition over to work for us. It's really huge.
And Ortiz notes, Peltola still has staffers, like himself, who are Alaskans and worked for other members of the Alaska delegation. While the House is in limbo, the first day in the Senate went entirely to plan. Senator Lisa Murkowski took the oath of office for the fifth time. She was accompanied to the well of the Senate by her father, former governor and former senator Frank Murkowski, as well as Senator Dan Sullivan. Reporting from the U.S. Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an update on the efforts to dig Anchorage out of last month's snowstorms.
There are still lanes that disappear as you're driving down traffic. We're, almost 3 weeks out from the last major snow event.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine. Protect yourself and family. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
The man who unsuccessfully challenged Alaska State Representative David Eastman's eligibility to hold office because of Eastman's membership in the far-right Oath Keepers group does not plan to file an appeal. Last month, State Superior Court Judge Jack McKenna found Eastman is not disqualified from holding office. He found that while Eastman is a member of the Oath Keepers, Eastman, quote, does not and did not possess a specific intent to further the Oath Keepers' words or actions aimed at overthrowing the United States government, end quote. An attorney who challenged Eastman's eligibility says that this decision would make it difficult or impossible to succeed on appeal. A spokesperson for the Division of Elections, which was a defendant in the case, said the division was still evaluating how it will respond to the decision and what its next steps will be. A Maine man convicted of a 1993 rape and murder at the University of Alaska Fairbanks has been appointed an attorney to represent him in an appeal. The Lewiston Sun Journal reports that 48-year-old Stephen Downs was recently assigned a public defender as he seeks a new trial for the sexual assault and killing of 20-year-old Sophie Sergey of Pitka's Point. Downs was a UAF student living in the Bartlett Hall dormitory where Sergey was found dead in April 1993. Downs was arrested in 2019 after DNA collected at the crime scene was matched to him. A Fairbanks jury convicted him last February, and a judge sentenced him in September to 75 years in prison. Downs filed a notice of appeal in October, at the same time his private attorneys withdrew from the case, saying Downs could no longer afford to pay them. Anchorage crews are still hauling snow off city roads after last month's three major snowstorms. City officials say they're making progress. But they also face challenges and growing frustration from some Anchorage residents who say it's taking too long. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports.
Some residents and city leaders, like Anchorage Assembly Vice Chair Chris Constan, say they're still unhappy with the amount of snow covering streets and sidewalks.
Snow is still a mess all over town. There are still lanes that disappear as you're driving down traffic. Almost 3 weeks out from the last major snow event.
Anchorage just had one of its snowiest Decembers on record, and snow from the three back-to-back storms has long clogged roadways, leading to fewer drivable lanes and longer commutes. City officials say crews have cleared thousands of truckloads of snow off the streets so far, and the work continues, but there are challenges. One of those challenges, the amount of snow. City spokesman Hans Rodvik said the city had to first focus on major busy streets when it began to tackle the snowfall. Then it moved into neighborhoods.
And we did that with single grader teams, more or less making one lane through neighborhoods to provide that access. We know it's not perfect.
He says many crew members worked more than 20 days in a row, day and night, to clear out the streets. Even over Christmas weekend, a smaller group continued to work.
I think it just took some time for us to source other contractors and get other help to begin these widening and hauling operations. So I imagine that some of that traffic backup that people did experience was attributed to that.
As of Thursday night, Acting Municipal Manager Kent Colhase says the city had hauled 320,000 cubic yards of snow, which he equated to 320,000 Maytag washing machines. In an email to the Anchorage Assembly Friday, Colhase said the contractor the city has been working with since the fall has, quote, been challenged in his ability to provide the number of trucks ordered on a daily basis. As a result, Colhase says the city has pulled snow dump trucks from many other departments and currently has a bid out for a new snow haul contractor. Mayor Dave Bronson's administration has faced criticism in recent weeks over the local equipment operators union warning city officials this summer of potential snowplow troubles due to longstanding staff and retention issues. Colhase laid out two other major snow clearing issues in his email. The first is snow-covered cars in the roads, which can hamper snowplow efforts. The second, private snow haul contractors pushing snow into public roads, which goes against city code. He says the ability to haul snow is also determined by the distance from snow dump sites. There are currently six available sites. On Thursday, Rodvik said it doesn't look like the snow dump sites will fill up anytime soon.
My understanding that we're working on getting some bulldozers out to the sites, push the snow back. Normally hauling doesn't happen until January, February timeframe, so we're a little early. Right now I think we're doing okay.
Constance says during Bronson's tenure, the assembly has had trouble getting up-to-date information on a variety of topics. However, he says he was happy with Colhase's snow haul update.
It's the most thorough briefing we've received from the administration in writing probably since June of 2021. And so I appreciate the fact that they're now making an effort to communicate with us in a way that we can get out to you.
Colhase recently took over as acting municipal manager after Amy Domboski was fired last month. He says crews are focused on hauling snow from main streets that are near schools, and he hopes to get every school cleared by the time classes resume after winter break on Monday, January 9th. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
After months of back and forth over a high-profile oil and gas lease sale in Cook Inlet, just one company placed bids. As KDLL's Sabine Pooks reports, that continues a trend of lukewarm interest from the industry in the inlet's federal waters.
Hilcorp Alaska was the sole bidder in last week's federal sale, dropping almost $64,000 on one tract in Lower Cook Inlet. The 2,000-acre tract is a small sliver of the nearly 1 million acres the Department of the Interior had put up for bid. Roger Marks says he's not surprised. He's an economist who's been watching Cook Inlet's oil and gas industry for four decades, and he says there's always been lethargic interest from companies in that part of the inlet.
You know, this was the market speaking, and the market, was pretty knowledgeable. And I think it just indicates that the federal outer continental shelf is just a poor place to think about developing oil and gas because of the geology.
Still, the sale has been hotly contested, and the auction rounds out a long saga of cancellations and rescheduling. Ultimately, the sale was written into federal law, part of the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act from Congress. Last Friday, as the clock wound down on the final days of 2022, the feds held a live reading of the results.
For today's sale, Bohm received one bid on one block. The bid is... Bid is for lease number Y02448, the OPB area.
The tract Hilcorp bought is not far from Chichitna Bay, near the west side of Lower Cook Inlet. It doesn't border existing Hilcorp properties, and it's unclear what the company wants with the tract. Hilcorp will not answer specific questions about the sale. Oil and gas companies play their cards close to their chest, so it's hard to know what they're finding when they look for gas in places like the inlet. But Mark says the continued lack of interest and the low price Hilcorp paid for the lease shows that the geology of the area is probably just not good.
All the production that's ever occurred in Cook Inlet going back to the 1950s has been on state acreage. So the geology on state acreage is good, just on the federal acreage, not good.
Hilcorp was the sole bidder in a state sale last week, where it picked up 6 leases in the upper part of the inlet. Sue Mauger is executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, one of the environmental groups that sued the feds over the sale last month, based on what they said was an incomplete environmental review process.
The fact that this sale was not successful is really a positive thing for Alaska and Alaskans.
She says the lack of new industry interest in both sales shows there are environmental and economic reasons both to not hold auctions there.
We have a win in that we won't have new emissions coming out of Cook Inlet with new development. However, we have to figure out what the future is for heating our homes.
Hilcorp provides South Central Alaska with most of its natural gas supply, which is used to heat homes and generate electricity. Last year, Hilcorp warned its buyers it might not have the supply to renew their contracts into the future. Mauger says the plaintiffs in the lawsuit are continuing with the suit and that they'll keep asking the Biden administration to not go forward with awarding the lease to Hilcorp. And she says long-term, they hope the feds don't hold any more lease sales in Cook Inlet. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Are you an Alaska artist or do you know one? March 1st is the deadline to apply for a Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Award. The program provides awards to artists, musicians, performers, writers, and culture bearers. Amounts are increasing. A project award, now $10,000, is available for an Alaska artist at any career stage. Mid-career and established artists may apply for a $25,000 artist fellowship. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. Rasmussen Foundation, promoting a better life for all Alaskans. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
A shakeup could be coming to Ketchikan's waterfront. City officials are considering a change to the way tour operators and food vendors compete for space on the city-owned cruise ship docks. As it stands, vendors bid for a spot, but Ketchikan City Council is scheduled to vote Thursday on a plan to move to a lottery system. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, officials say it's an effort to allow newer and smaller businesses to capitalize on publicly owned infrastructure.
When passengers walk off cruise ships in downtown Ketchikan, among the crowds and buses are 6 small booths bearing the names of various tour companies. 2 more sell food, fish and chips and the like. Every 3 years, the city holds an auction for those booths. Vendors list the maximum price they're willing to pay in a sealed bid auction, and the top bidders get the chance to hawk their tours to disembarking tourists on Ketchikan's cruise ship docks. This past year, the program brought in roughly $370,000 in rent for the city's port fund. But it's not meant to be a significant revenue stream for the city, according to Ketchikan's Port and Harbors Director, Daryl Verfai, who joined the city staff last year. Instead, it's supposed to give businesses an opportunity to capitalize on the city's publicly owned port infrastructure. But those opportunities have been limited to a select few tour operators. Over the past 10 years, Verfai says essentially the same 6 vendors have been the top bidders for dock leases. He says some of those operators have held leases since 2004. And he says the system provides essentially the same service to the companies at vastly different costs. In some cases, the top bidder paid nearly $40,000 more than the lowest successful bidder over the course of a season. Making things worse, the Port and Harbors director says the system appears to be unfair. Though he doesn't name names, Verfai says the disparities were exacerbated by, quote, the appearance of collusionary practices among some past leaseholders that had the potential to secure an advantage over other bidders, end quote. So he's proposing what he calls a hard reset of the program to allow small businesses a fairer shot at the leases. It would be a lottery. Essentially, anyone who wants to sell tours or food on the docks would submit an application, and they'd be drawn at random to determine who gets a spot. The cost of the lease would be up to the city council, and the specifics of the lottery would be up to the city manager. But the proposal is likely to face pushback from existing vendors. John Maloof of Ketchikan Duck Tour and Alaska Hummer Adventures says he's not convinced the system actually is excluding businesses.
Last time we had 6 bidders, there were 6 booths. So if there were some kind of 24 bidders and 6 booths, maybe there'd be some ground to stand on there. But the year before that, we had 7 bidders out of 6 booths. So I think there's opportunity for people to get in if they want to bid.
Steve McDonald of Dolly's Enterprises called the plan ridiculous, bizarre, and asinine. He didn't want to be recorded, but he said that businesses that run dock booths have invested heavily in their operations, and they could face an uncertain future if the council adopts a lottery system. He estimated the city's existing dock vendors employ roughly 300 people. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
A dozen quilters are donating their work of Ukrainian sunflowers to raise money for emergency food in Ukraine. The exhibit is the January 6th First Friday event at Wells Street Gallery in Fairbanks. KUAC's Robin has more.
Quilter Lindy Kinn said she was inspired by a pattern of a sunflower square that the designer Emily Taylor was using for fundraising.
And she offered the pattern, and 100% of the proceeds went to aid Ukraine. It was a sunflower pattern, and I was inspired by that to carry it a little further on.
Lindy Kinn got with another quilting instructor, Robin Benjamin, and the two of them coordinated a class with the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at UAF. They used a technique called collage quilting, in which visuals are built up with several pieces of cloth stitched or fused together to make one color.
Most of them started off with Emily's pattern, but they all look different because everybody put their own special twist on it.
The class met through October and November and worked up the colorful sunflowers, the national flower of Ukraine. Kinn said recently it's become a symbol of solidarity and resistance against the country's invasion by Russian forces. She said she had two objectives for the class: to have the students display their works in a formal show as accomplished artists, and she wanted to give them a way to help with the war in Ukraine.
I encouraged the participants to put their sunflower on a field of blue to represent the Ukrainian flag.
Each student made one or two yellow and blue 14-inch squares. Kinn selected World Central Kitchen as a charity to receive the money.
A place that we could send it to that I knew was reputable and had a history of doing good things with the money they receive.
World Central Kitchen provides meals in response to humanitarian, climate, and community crises. Benjamin said the class was a creative way that artists could regain a sense of agency when feeling helpless about the war.
You know, everybody can do something. You don't have to feel like you see these terrible things going on in the world and you don't feel like you can do anything about it. But really, there are lots and lots of different ways that you can even make a small contribution. It all adds up.
Benjamin said the quilters worked up almost 20 squares to donate for sale. She took them last week to Wells Street Gallery in Fairbanks. They plan to ask $85 for each sunflower.
I mean, we were thrilled that, you know, everyone in the class was able to produce and finalize their project. They made a donation. They worked hard.
Gallery owner David Mollett is donating labor and processing for the First Friday event so all the money from the quilt sales can be donated. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Claire Strempel in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross and Robin in Fairbanks, Wesley Early in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, and Eric Stone in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Madeline Rose is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline since 1977, from Prudhoe Bay to the Port of Valdez.
And by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks with 400 guest rooms and 1,700 square feet of meeting space. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.